Devin Nunes here, back for my podcast here in the San Joaquin Valley, always bringing a little San Joaquin Valley flavor to the national and state scene. One of the Valley's legends is with us today, Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, a longtime professor. He's with the Hoover Institute and a real expert on a whole host of subjects. But today I want to do something a little bit different because it's the second time that we're here at Gartutilian. A longtime Armenian family here in the Valley, and I thought it would be interesting for us to get a little flavor from Victor for the folks that lived here, immigrated to the San Joaquin Valley, especially a little touch on the Armenian genocide. And then I want to get to kind of a historical reference on this radical Antifa movement by the far left that I like to get into. Yeah. So that's going to be the topic of our podcast today. And so, Victor, with that, the Tutilian family, they supply products to farmers so that they can grow crops, is simply put. But they also come from one of the proud Armenian families that have a long history here in the Valley. And, of course, there were actually not just one, but two genocides that resulted in many Armenians moving here to this part of the Valley around the turn of the century. And being that you're in one of the... Your family's been here a long time also, but you're familiar with the Armenian culture.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Selma. I live in Selma. And the Armenians are one of a number of groups, Japanese Americans, Portuguese, Greeks, Middle Eastern people who came to the Valley to farm. And they brought a diversity of experience. It was a natural diversity. It wasn't an artificially government constructed. And they turned what we're looking out the window that was a desert into a garden. In the case of the Armenians, they occupy the same historical role as the Jewish people, the Kurds, that they were victims, mostly because of their faith in the Middle East that was primarily Islamic and Ottoman, and the first genocide at the end of the 19th century, then the terrible one that saw the transition to the new Turks, so to speak, at the end of World War I. And all in all, about 1 million Armenian people were displaced, killed, or imprisoned. And hundreds of thousands came to California and the East Coast, but mostly here in Los Angeles and the Central Valley, and they enriched the culture. They created the raisin industry in some ways, and they're part of, again, a number of highly dynamic and energized ethnic groups that came in and under the melting pot assimilated and enriched the United States.
Most of the, you mentioned raisins for our listeners. Raisins are actually grapes, mostly Thompson, mostly Thompson grapes. And I know you were a farmer, and you still live on your farm. But you know, we're here in Reedley, which is tucked up right by the Sierra Nevadas. Victor, you live just 20 miles west of here, outside of Selma, on your farm. But if we look at the raisin industry, it's pretty much all the raisins. I think over 90% of the raisins in the United States are within 40 miles of where we sit right now.
Yes, and it was founded by people who came into California, a lot of them from the American South, and at the turn of the century and even before, and then ethnic groups from Greece and Armenia that had experience in sultana grapes. And once they mastered the cultivation of the Thompson seedless, it boomed, and at one time SunMade had 90% of the raisin industry. Now it's much less. But it, like all agriculture, it's a constantly evolving, highly competitive, highly export-dependent industry. And so the number of raisin growers has shrunk while the productivity per acre has increased due to sophisticated hybridization and trellising, and the farms are getting larger. But it's a very tough business. I was in it for 30 years, and I have only admiration for people who can make a living at it.
Yeah, my family was also in the business, actually grew raisins also. Just to finish up on the Armenian genocide, so I always like to talk, I like maps and geography. And so when you look at the Ottoman Empire, which stretched across Central Asia all the way up into Europe, but Armenia today, when you look at Armenia on the map, what a lot of people don't realize is that what we today, many people would call Western Armenia, is gone, and it's now part of Turkey.
Yes, and Armenia suffered in a variety of ways historically. It was the first Christian country that had Christianity as an avowed national religion in the world in the 9th century, even the 8th century. It sort of canonized Christianity, and it was in a sea of Islam, and it had no ports, it had no sea coast. And then it was juxtaposed between two tough neighbors, Russia and the Ottoman Empire. And it suffered the same vulnerabilities that I said earlier, the Kurds, the Jews, any group in the Middle East that wasn't Orthodox, Arab, or Turkish and Islamic, whether it was the Sufi Muslims or another one, suffered enormously because they were just simply outnumbered. And many of these political and religious orthodoxies were intolerant. And that's one of the reasons I think the United States has typically been a friend of Kurdish people, Jewish people, Greek people, Armenian people, because we sympathize with the ordeal they have to put up with. And without our support, in many cases, they would be existentially threatened.
The Armenian people are tough. And I've been to Armenia. I assume you have also. But the geography there, you can understand how they were able to survive for so long in such a rough neighborhood, yeah. Because they were able to take the high ground, and this gets yes. into your classicist background, but they were able to defend the high ground. They had a climate very similar to here. They were yes. able to grow, they were able to feed their army, so to speak, and that's how they were able to survive. Can you walk us through an interesting battle or two that you're familiar with?
Well, Armenia and Greece, they're both similar, and in the sense that as colonies of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans could control the plains, and they took the richest fertile ground, and then they drove people who would not convert to Islam up to the mountains. That had a historically fragmented effect, because if you go to, say, Greece or Armenia today, you see these villages, and they make no economic sense because they're not at transits of easy transportation or fertile ground. But they had the unintended effect of creating, as you said, a hardy mountain people, and they were able to survive because in the way of the Ottoman proconsuls, they weren't worth the effort to go up there and physically drag people out. So they kept alive their language, they kept alive their religion, and they kept their culture alive. The problem with all of these peoples, and Byzantine Greeks especially along the coast of Ionia, is that demography was not in their favor. And I don't want to be too controversial, but they were adherents of a religion whose canons were the Sermon on the Mount and Turn the Other Cheek, and they were up against a religion that felt that conversion by force earned destiny in the life hereafter. So there was a lot of things that were against them, and we don't like to talk about that in the politically correct environment today, but Greeks and Armenians, I think, are very similar, and I'm worried today, as you are probably, that there's disturbing signs coming out of Turkey, whether it's the Erdogan government, the neo-Ottomanism, the intolerance, the anger at the United States, their affinities with Iran, that put those historically vulnerable people once again in some danger, and we really have to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, the Turkish longtime NATO ally, the Turks are, but I'll tell you, it's getting more and more difficult to be able to work with them, and it's not a good sign. And just finally, for the audience to understand, just kind of wrapping up this little piece on Armenia, what amazed me was my first time ever going to Jerusalem.
Yes.
And to seeing a quarter of Jerusalem from the old city.
Yes.
Controlled by the Armenians.
Yes.
What's the background there?
Well, the background simply is that when the Roman Empire Christianized in the 4th century, it turned out that Tigranes and the Armenian, from a long tradition of Armenia, had been a friend, a client kingdom of the Roman Empire. But once it Christianized, the Armenians took it to a level that the other colonies, or I should say provinces, didn't. And so they had a population that was the most Christianized of any province of the Roman Empire. And then when it came under the domain of the Byzantine East, they were very prominent in the orthodoxy of the what we call then the Orthodox, and then that fragmented to Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Armenian. But the bottom line is that because they were so Christian from the very beginning, and they were so influential in the administration of Roman provincial land, they went into Jerusalem and people gave them a level of authority and prestige that other peoples with that small a population didn't have.
It's amazing, Victor. I could talk for hours and hours on this subject, many of these subjects with you. You're one of the brightest minds in terms of a classicist historian. But just bringing it back to the valley here, big Armenian population here. You've got the Armenians that are left in present-day Armenia, the plains, as you would say. Yeah. Western Armenia is gone today. No more Armenians are left there. And so you've got a pocket in Jerusalem, very proud people, and then a few pockets here in the United States. Yeah. So things are getting pretty radical here in the United States, the politics. And there's a lot of talk that this is something new, this resistance movement. But what I've been saying recently is this resistance movement, this Antifa movement, when I started in politics at the beginning of my career, was during the George W. Bush administration. And what I see today was, this is the 2.0 version of what they started against the Republicans and George W. Bush. So in 2000, you had the close election of with Gore and the recount. Where George W. Bush won by just a hair. In 2000, then we got into Iraq. They politicized Iraq, and no matter what your feeling, no matter what your opinion is on whether we should have went into Iraq, it's easy today, I think, to play Monday morning quarterback on that subject. But they began to politicize the war. The left did, and the Democrats. In 2004, John Kerry ran, and they believe for sure John Kerry had this locked up. Yeah. And when George W. Bush fairly easily beat John Kerry at the end. Nobody thought that was possible, for sure the Democrats. And that was when they became very, what I would say, this first violent kind of strand of politics that you see in modern times, where they began to disrupt committee hearings. They began to wear pink hats, and they called it, I can't even remember the name that they called it, it was like
Code Pink.
Code Pink. And I know, because you had a lot of the, and MoveOn.org began, which was a George Soros-funded operation. And by 2006, because of the unpopularity of George W. Bush and the Iraq War, the Republicans and this radical movement, the Republicans were swept from office. And you had Republicans didn't even want to admit they were Republicans at the time. That's different today. It's different today in that Republicans are very happy with the president. They're very happy with the economy. But can you talk to us about the similarities that you see between that Code Pink MoveOn.org movement, which I call the first in the first movement, which is now the resistance, and Antifa is really 2.0 of that. Yeah. Can we talk about that?
A couple of things. Thematically, they share the same doctrine that they have a noble ends of virtue, and they're superior, they think, in their morality, and therefore it justifies any means necessary to achieve their goals. That's the same. But just take a couple examples. Johnny Depp said the other day that he wished John Wilkes Booth was back to kill
the president. Yeah.
But where did he get that? Charles Booker wrote in 2005 in an op-ed in The Guardian that he wished John Wilkes Booth was back to kill George W. Bush. Gabriel Range wrote a book, documentary, Death of a President, that won an award in the Toronto Film, reenacting what it would be like, I shouldn't say reenacting, but enacting a fantasy of killing George W. Bush. I'll just name a couple of names, more than a couple, John Glenn, Al Gore, Garrison Keillor, Linda Ronstadt, they all said in one way or another that Bush was a Nazi or a brown shirt or digital brown shirt. We remember Ward Churchill, his whole career got out of the university campus and into the public sphere because he said there were little Eichmanns that were at that had died on 9/11. We forget that Michael Moore said, "Hey, I wish it had have been a red state and not New York, a blue state," as if it was okay for people to be killed if they were conservative on 9/11. And you know, there was a novel called Checkpoint, and the whole novel, I read it. It was pretty depressing. by Nicholas Baker, and it was trying to have to trying to envision exactly how to kill George Bush. The difference, I think, today is that the Karl Rove, George W. Bush approach was, let's all be friends, play kumbaya, and let's not apply and stoop down at their level. And that Marcus of Queensbury rules Republicanism was discredited because Bush left office with the lowest approval rating, 22%. General Petraeus was smeared as General Betrayus, you remember that?
Yep.
And Hillary Clinton basically, in his Senate testimony, you know that better than I do, called him a liar. And that approach didn't work. And so people in 2016, and they saw John McCain do the same thing, and they saw Mitt Romney, and they said, you know what? We want a fighter. We want somebody who gets down at their level. We want a Lee Atwater-like campaign again that had, in 1988, had won the election for George H.W. Bush by going after Dukakis. I'm not adjudicating the morality or the ethics. I'm just saying that lackadaisical play by the rules had not worked. And when Donald Trump came, people said to themselves, if they try to hijack a debate like they did with Mitt Romney and have Candy Crowley, Trump won't put up with that. Or if they call his family names, he'll strike back. And so I think we're forgetting that Trump is a reaction to what you're talking about that had its precursors all during the George W. Bush administration.
Right. Everybody is saying that this is this is because of Trump that this is happening. The reality is, and just to put kind of an explanation point on it, is no, these radicals were here. Well, we dealt with them, but you had George W. Bush and the Republicans who would not fight back. I'm not being critical of George W. Bush. I mean, I think even at that time, we just wanted to be civil. We wanted mm-hmm. to put the facts on the table and try to debate them. And we thought that we could win on the facts. But what's really happened is that what we've known for a long time, I always call it the 90% rule. 90% of the media is not just hard left, but they're political actors at the same time. And what President Trump has really done is he's just brought all of them out.
Yeah, I think that's good.
They're just totally out.
He kind of exposed people for what they always were, but they were very careful to hide. So the media has always been, according to statistical analysis, 90% in its coverage pro-Democratic. But they, under Trump, they became so loud. And, I mean, my gosh, we've been told that Trump should be beheaded, he should be burned alive, hanged, drawn and quartered, stabbed. We've had people praying for his demise at CNN. A couple of people were caught on a hot mic. We've seen, we've just seen this writer for the New York Times editorial page, Sarah Jung, who said some really racist things and did not lose her job in a way. The New York Times has called for others of similar offenses to be demise. So Trump, I kind of see him as a chemotherapy drug. He's saying that there's a cancer in the country, and that is that this any means necessary is unhealthy, and it's polluting or diseasing, if I should use that term, the entire body politic. And I'm going to go in there as a toxic anecdote and play just as tough as they are, and I'm going to try to neutralize them before they weaken and destroy the entire body politic. And that has caused a lot of never-Trumpers, not influential as far as voting, but in commentary and punditry, this never Trump withdrawal or repulsion about Trump's tactics is something that makes the whole thing more complex and difficult to get a handle on.
And I also believe, Victor, that President Trump didn't really know what he was getting into with the media. Because at first, the media was really on his side. And I think he probably believed that they were very friendly and that he was working with them. And he'd call them up on the phone. They'd patch him through.
Yeah,
but they were promoting him because the media believed that, boy, if Trump could get through,
yes,
the Republicans will never win.
Exactly.
And what happened was then Trump gets through the primary, wins the primary, and then immediately they turn on him.
Yes.
And then Trump figured out, wow, these guys were never helping me. And now, so he just started, just like he hit the Republicans back when they attacked him, the other candidates in the primary, he hits back to the media.
Yeah.
And the media has gotten worse and worse and worse. They completely outed themselves. Yeah. I mean, they're I mean, they're unhinged in this country, yeah. The media is right now.
No, they are. And I remember Les Moonves, the president of CBS, said that Trump was a godsend to us. That was during the primaries. And what he meant was really overtly, he's created so much attention that we're getting spectacular ratings. But he also meant in the process, he's going to destroy the Republican brand, and then Hillary will walk in. And what he didn't realize is those skill sets that Trump used to demolish 16 rivals, they were not a one-time event, that he could apply those to Hillary Clinton. So they kind of, if I could use overdramatic metaphors, they thought they were Dr. Frankenstein and they'd created this monster, ha-ha, and it was going to turn on him, but it turned on them.
Right.
Because during that distilling process of the primary, Trump got stronger and more effective in his technique and his mode. And then when he got into the general election, he really neutralized Hillary Clinton, and then you're right. Then all of a sudden, he's a monster, and we've got to destroy him. And he replied in kind to them, and they did not think that any Republican would dare do that.
And I like to compare. We have a little bit of background in having a kind of a Hollywood, New York showman get elected.
Yeah.
Here in California, we're familiar with that because we watched the whole Arnold Schwarzenegger,
yes,
phenomenon. And what I tell people is that about you know, I watched kind of both of them closely, and what I see is with Schwarzenegger, he got into office and he never really grew in office. He kind of just eventually did the go along to get along thing, and now if you really watch him, he's always playing with the media. He wants the media to like him. But with Trump, what I've seen over the last year and a half is he gets into issues and he learns them. And he gets better and better and better. A lot of times, there's no question, I think, that we're like, oh my gosh, where did that tweet come from, of all things? But if you look at it, I think he's becoming more and more consistent. There's fewer tweets that are kind of something that I would never say. And I think to some degree, the Republicans are learning things from him, and I think he's learning things from us as we try to move forward and govern. And if you look at the end of the day, the most consequential piece of legislation was passed, which was the complete gutting of the tax code. Yeah. I think this is the most important legislation that's been passed since Medicaid passed in the 60s.
Yeah. A couple of things. Remember when Schwarzenegger took over The Apprentice? He bombed in the first episode. He never had, for all of his wealth and his celebrity, he never had the repartee and the showman skills that Trump did. Second, he violated the primary canon, and you know that better than I do, of political protocol. You never turn on your base. You enlarge your base. As soon as he got into governorship, once he couldn't get his agenda, he flipped and became a green guru, sort of, and alienated his base. Trump took his base and said, you people were the forgotten people. People make fun of you, but you're not done yet. You're not demographically extinct yet. We're going to restore this energy that used to be in places in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina. And that that dynamism is reflected in these statistics, 3.9% unemployment today, 4.1% GDP, good stock, record stock market. And other people are saying, you know what? That's a paradigm that affects me positively, whether you're looking at Hispanic unemployment or black unemployment, which are at record lows. And so he was able to take a paradigm that was designed for a particular demographic and expand that. And I think he's going to be, when you have somebody like Mr. Trumpka and the unions are bewildered by him, because they say, wow, coal, energy, unemployment's good, talks about working class values. He's not just one of these elitists that's unfortunately in our party. And that's what terrifies the Democrats, that he's the first Republican candidate that threatens their base. And that brings out a hysteria and an anger. And they're moving more and more to the left. And insidiously, they're ceding Trump the middle. And if he can discipline himself and not alienate some rubrics like, you know, educated women or independents, I think he'll do much better even in the midterms than people are thinking in 2020, a lot better.
Well, there's no question that the guy works all the time. I don't know when he actually sleeps. He's got the media on their toes. And quite frankly, I've enjoyed watching it, because having to deal with these these left-wing media guys for so long, it's nice to have somebody actually taking them on directly and fighting with them. And I think a lot of people are coming to, a lot of people are stepping up and willing to fight too because of the leadership and that we haven't had before. Yeah. And I think you know that's part of the reason that I've created this podcast is because it's one way that I now have to get around the mainstream media and go directly to constituents, directly to people around the state and the nation with an unfiltered message from me and from people like yourself that are experts in many, many fields, and we don't have to be regulated by whatever quote they want to pick or whatever they want to create for their little 1 minute news segment. So thank you so much, Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, coming from Gar Tutillion here in Reedley, California, in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley. The Devin Nunes Podcast, trying to bring a little San Joaquin Valley flavor to the nation, the state, and all over the world.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams. It whips the dust up and rains pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We've started wondering if we even matter at all. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we've kept our American faith. Now it's not our first trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can't fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we kept our American faith. We the people free and strong fight through the dark night toward the dawn. Freedom marches on.
That's why they call her the home of the brave.
With a prayer and a purpose, we're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.